If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
When everything is moving all at once, your workforce, your tech stack, your business, you don't need more tools. You need one solution. That's why Paylocity built a single platform to connect HR, finance, and IT with AI-driven insights and automated workflows that simplify the complex and power what's next. Because when everything comes together in one place, growth comes easy. Experience one place for all your HCM needs. Start now at paylocity.com/one.
Father, or should I call you Steve? Since it's a new year, maybe we should start cooking fresh with fewer smoke alarms this time. Your cooking's improving, but I can see the stress in your eyes. Anna's mom used this Blue Apron Assemble and Bake thing during our playdate. Pre-chopped ingredients, over 40 grams of protein, and just one pan to clean up. She just tossed it in the oven and boom, plating like she's got followers. So go to blueapron.com, Steve. Make 2026 the year you win dinner. Blue Apron. Get $50 off your first two orders plus free shipping with code STIR50. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, this is Zibby Owens, host of Totally Booked with Zibby, formerly Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. In my daily show, I interview today's latest, best-selling, buzziest, or underrated authors and story creators whose work I think is worth your time. As a bookstore owner, publisher, author, and obviously podcaster, I get a comprehensive look at everything that's coming out and spend my time curating the best books so you don't have to. Stay in the know, get insider insights, and connect with guests like Grammy Award-winning singer Alicia Keys, critically acclaimed author Judy Blume, and Academy Award-winning screenwriter John Irving every single day. With Totally Booked, you aren't just listening, you're part of the story. So don't miss out. Follow Totally Booked with Zibby on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. An opportunity to tune into what matters, turn on to the best ways of expressing it, and then drop out of the institutions that simply won't rise to the occasion. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, the tech culture journalist behind User Mag, Taylor Lorenz. Taylor and I are going to consider the demise of the Washington Post and whether tech billionaires really want the rest of us dead. It's time to intervene on behalf of people and all living things. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. Hey,
Hi, thanks for having me.
God, thanks so much for doing this. So for those of you who don't know, and I'm pretty sure anybody who knows me, I'm like a subset of the fan base of Taylor. She's, you know, writing now, the writing and producing and editing and everything on the magazine User Mag, which is at usermag.co, or I guess you can sort of find it on Substack. She's also the author of the book Extremely Online, The Untold Story of Fame, Influence, and Power on the Internet. She, like me, and this is, there are very few of us who really do this, she focuses on the cultural side of digital media. And even though one might intend to focus on the cultural side of digital media, you can't do that without occasionally having to venture into the negative space of business and politics, which so often seeks to enclose, prescribe, or even just prevent us from exercising the kind of agency that humans like to in cultural social spaces. So I, for years, have wanted to kind of compare notes both on the journey that you've been through and sort of the journey that we as a society have been through in this internet thing. We got slightly different generational perspectives, and maybe, I don't know, I like to become more happy or hopeful after these conversations. Maybe that will happen.
I hope so.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I kind of want to ask is, and obviously with anything, just go as deep as you want to, but I'm interested. I look at you, you got out. You got out. You know, you left, and I just always love people who do this. You were like New York Times, then Washington Post, you know, like the person writing about this with the giant tweets that everybody knew and articles every week. Did you see what Taylor wrote this week? Did you see what Lorenz wrote that week? But you got out voluntarily. You got out. So I'm wondering how you made the decision. How did your mom react when you explained, you know what I mean, to do that?
Yeah. My sister worked at the Washington Post for like 7 years or something. So but she was doing PR. My mom doesn't really care, but what I do, as long as I'm happy. But I started as an independent blogger, and most of my career was, I mean, I worked in like digital media before I worked in traditional media. And in 2017, I had a Snapchat show covering the 2016 election, and then that was doing really well also into 2017. And then I felt like nobody back then was taking independent. Now people take independent journalists seriously, but back then, even though my Snapchat show was with The Hill, but like because I was doing video journalism, it was always seen as subpar. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to have to like take a massive pay cut and just like basically be a writer at these like ancient places, because like that's kind of the only way that these like journalism people will like understand that I'm doing journalism. So I took a job at The Atlantic, which I loved. I've always had amazing editors. Honestly, I would die for all of them. But yeah, so I worked at The Atlantic, and then like the New York Times came and like offered to double my salary. And then like I was at the Times for a few years, and then the Post came and was like, do you want to be a columnist? And I was like, sure. And I got to work for this guy, Mark Seibel, who is the best editor to have ever existed. He retired last year, which is why I left. And yeah, the week that he retired on Friday. And then that Sunday, they fired our first female editor-in-chief, Sally. They pushed out all of like the leadership. Basically, that a year ago is when like this whole decline started. And I was like, okay, well, Mark was the only reason I was here, and I don't want to like be part of. They were like trying to get us to join these groups, like build it, fix it, like whatever. And I was like, I don't want to do that. I just want to do my own thing. So then I just quit, and now I'm doing my own thing. But I'm glad I had my time in those places, because it gave me a lot of like, I used to write when I started out these like hit like negative critiques of places like the New York Times and stuff, and I never really understood what it was like inside those places, and I just think I have a lot more nuanced understanding of how power works within those institutions now.
Right. Do you think their coverage of the net and of digital media was too, I don't know, either like pro-corporate in?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like they don't understand technology outside of a business story. So like a lot of their coverage, I mean, I was on the business team. I was always on the business desk. Mm. I guess at The Atlantic, I was on tech, like just their tech section. But they cover it more through the lens of like Meta's stock is up, or like through like, here's what Elon Musk is doing. Like, and I cover tech from the user side. So it's like, how are the people, how is it being used? How are the people who are exerting influence on these platforms, like influencers, which I primarily cover, like the influencer economy, like how are they exerting power online? And like, what is that relationship to these platforms? And so they just never take that stuff as seriously, I think, as like the like fundraising announcement from Mark Andreessen or like that type of stuff.
Yeah. And it's interesting because back in the real back in the day, like when I was just starting, 92, 93, 94, back before they thought there was any business at all to be done, the only place you could write tech stories was on the culture page, was on the arts page. So I'm writing, it was so fun. So I'm writing like, you know, kind of Mondo 2000 style articles, you know, like about virtual reality and psychedelics and the future of email, or, you know, pre-social social about MUDs and, you know, dungeons and things online. And the business wanted nothing to do with it. It wasn't until that day that AOL was going to buy Time Warner. It's like 1999 that all of a sudden the business people came and they're like, oh, write about this, write about that. And they wouldn't let me write about it if I wasn't saying why this synergy was the greatest, blah, blah, since sliced bread. And I'd always look at it from, well, how is this affecting? Now I sound like you. How is this affecting the user? Right. How does this yeah. change the way we use this stuff? And they weren't interested. So I know it's strange, but yeah, even the speaking, I ended up doing business conferences like Web 2.0 and O'Reilly this. And it's like, I'm just interested in that 17-year-old girl who's thinking differently about the world now because she gets her advice from here instead of there.
But they don't take those people seriously. And it's interesting you mentioned teen girls, because like those are some of the earliest adopters on so much technology. I wrote a piece back in 2023 that was on the 10-year anniversary of selfie being named word of the year. And I wrote about like the media coverage of selfies, which was so insane back in 2013. Like, and I remember this because I was right out of college. And like, I remember reading this stuff. And it was like, basically, everyone that takes a selfie is a narcissistic psychopath. It's ruining society. Like, it's the downfall of, and so much of it was just this like deeply misogynistic framing about women who were the primarily people like putting themselves in selfie images and stuff. So I see that a lot, unfortunately, in legacy media to this day, where like if you look at their like internet culture cover, like so much of their coverage is just like, look at these stupid young people. It has no respect for the people that they're covering.
No, it's funny because 2013, I did this documentary, Generation Like, and it was for PBS Frontline. And I was trying to do, let's look at it all, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, and it's PBS. So they kept, it's like leaning into like the hand wringing. Oh, what about, you know, oh, but is this girl, what is she showing? And what is her self-image? And what's that? So I showed the two extremes, the boy extreme and the girl extreme, you know, in it. But then look at this kid who decided he's going to create a company, because there are also just as many teens who are like creating whole new ways for people to interact.
Yeah. Or like, I mean, I grew up in like as a kid and a teenager in the 2000s, which had the worst media environment ever. It was dominated by legacy media publications and tabloid media specifically, that was so deeply misogynistic and evil towards women, like truly horrible stuff that they were, when I was doing research for my book, I was like, I can't believe some of this stuff was published in like 2007, like these countdowns for Mary-Kate and Ashley to turn 18. And like, just this is like disgusting way that people talked about like Britney Spears. And like that media environment was so toxic. Talk about promoting eating disorders. Like that's all it did. And then we have the internet that gives rise to like body positivity and all the, I was a Tumblr girly, and like, it really like showed you like different understandings of gender and sexuality and all this stuff. And like none of the media never focused on that. It was just this like moral panic framing that was really like disrespectful and not nuanced. And I think ultimately allowed like a lot of blame to be allocated for like the users. Like if you, that selfie stuff was like, there's this woman, Jean, I can never say her last name, Twenge or whatever.
Yeah.
She was like the leader of all that. And now, you know, she's pushing like authoritarianism and like surveillance capitalism. And like, it just like devolved so quickly.
And it's hard. I get it. If I'm a congressman or a senator, it's like, will you please protect our kids from Mark Zuckerberg? Mark Zuckerberg doesn't like your kids. The people running TikTok don't like your kids. It's like Larry Ellison now is running TikTok.
Yeah.
Or something. So it's like, sure, regulate these people. Get Cory Doctorow down here. Let's regulate. But what you've been pointing out in some of your later pieces is some of this regulation is really just backdoor Palantir surveillance by another name.
It's a massive, massive reward to big tech. It's the biggest gift that we could ever give to big tech. That's why all of these tech companies are pre-complying. That's why, I mean, let's not forget that, like, Elon Musk, like, you know, informed the language of COSA, the Kids Online Safety Act. Do you think Elon Musk cares about child safety? Like, it's just such a farce.
What is the farce?
I would love to see regulation against big tech. I would love to see them target the actual, like, hyper-capitalist business models. Like, I think it's such a tragedy that last year, you know, both of the Google and Meta, like, antitrust cases were lost. Like, I would have loved to see I understand the reasons why those failed, but, like, there's so much anti-competitive behavior from these companies that we don't even bother to prosecute. And bigger than that, we don't have data privacy in this country. Like, for all that I covered the TikTok ban extensively for the Times and then the Post, they were doing this like nonsense moral panic about like fake TikTok trends that didn't exist. But the reality is that China can buy as much of our data, anyone, including bad actors, can buy as much American data as possible. And the government, including places like, you know, ICE and stuff, is they're primarily relying on commercially available data to do what they're doing. And that's because we don't have comprehensive data privacy protections in this country, which, if you do buy into the premise of Jean, whatever, you know, and no hate, I'm not like trying to like put her on blast or something, but like, you know, a lot of these people where they say, oh, you know, the predatory algorithms. Well, the companies are able to target your children with extreme content, predatory stuff, hook them in that way because of the massive amount of data that they're harvesting. And you think that now having little Johnny, you know, scan, input his biometric data in addition to all of that is going to help? Like, no, you're just exacerbating these problems. You're not doing anything to fix them.
The regulations they want to do are like what? Are for kids to scan stuff in there?
Yeah. It's to allow tech companies to harvest even more data.
But the idea, I mean, it's just for listeners who haven't been following, the idea is we're going to protect your kids from these companies. And the way they're going to do it is by what? Making sure that kids are a certain age before they are able to log into something?
So the goal, let's be clear about the goal too, is to remove anonymity from the internet. The government has sought to do this for years. There's also this far right reactionary movement to dismantle Section 230 protections and basically eliminate the ability for user-generated content online. So there's a lot of these sort of like self-interested authoritarian efforts going on, and they're selling it under the guise of this moral panic about children. And the response to that is these politicians saying like, okay, yeah, we're not going to target the business models of big tech. We're not going to go after, you know, Meta's our biggest funder. We're not going to do anything meaningful to curb their business model. Instead, we're going to regulate you, the users. You are going to have to scan your face. Basically, you will no longer have the ability to anonymously access information online, and you will no longer have the ability to anonymously speak online, or if in the UK, the EU with chat control, even message.
So then the gist of it is then under the guise of being able to enforce parental or age restrictions on, say, porn sites, they're just going to have everybody's retina scans up in the and the DNA and whatever.
Yeah. That's the tip of the iceberg. They're harvesting, like, I mean, these companies are very interested in tying your offline identity to your online behavior because that's very valuable for advertisers. That's very valuable data. That's why Peter Thiel, you know, invested in Persona through Founders Fund. Persona is the number one identity verification tool that you know, platforms like Roblox and all these other Reddit and stuff are using. Like, this is a massively lucrative industry, especially as we see the rise of AI, and all of this data becomes incredibly valuable. So instead of allowing them to create more value for, you know, new AI systems or whatever, like, we should be curbing their value. We used to haul Mark Zuckerberg in front of Congress for harvesting too much data. Now we have Meta pre-complying with laws that are...
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What if you laughed all through your commute? Or if you heard the funniest story while at the gym? Well, now you can. I'm Jameela Jamil, and guests on my new podcast, Wrong Turns, share their most mortifying and hilarious disaster stories. I'm talking people like Mae Martin, Bob the Drag Queen, Catherine Ryan, Jake Johnson, Margaret Cho, Simon Pegg, Penn Badgley, and so many more. So listen wherever you get your podcast, Wrong Turns, where dignity goes to die.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Harvesting mass amounts of data on children, and they're just able to do it because they're like, oh, it's going to protect kids to, you know, again, scan everyone's face, adults included. It's crazy.
Right. I mean, on one hand, I look at it and think, well, maybe the easiest way to combat the commoditization of all of our data, everyone put everything out. In other words, create a data commons that then there's no value to it because we all have each other's data.
No. That's not the way it's going to go for you. Because the thing is, maybe that would work if that data wasn't valuable. This data is incredibly valuable. I mean, look at what Google did, just announced, right, like a week ago, that they're going to be testing targeted deals, aka surveillance pricing, right? Like, where suddenly, or what happened with Instacart, right? Certain people are being charged 23% more for their grocery orders based on their data. So as surveillance pricing and AI and all this stuff integrates, we already see this type of discrimination happening with people getting different rates for car loans, for rental applications, all this stuff. Like, your data will be used against you for healthcare denials. Now they know that you personally were chatting with a friend on Discord, right, about, like, health issues. Like, all of this data gets fed into these AI systems that ultimately will be used to exploit you. So we shouldn't want that.
I know. They're not supposed to be. It's supposed to be private. They're not supposed to see that.
But we don't have privacy. We're eroding. My issue is, like, we're eroding privacy in the name of kids' safety. I'm all for keeping kids
right.
safe. Let's start by not allowing these tech companies to target them and harvest even more data.
So the kid safety is like another version of, you know, Trump administration saying we need to get whatever they were called, Doge, into all the
yes.
companies and take all the employee data in order to make sure there's no employees making too much money. It's like, where's that data going? It's like back into Trump's Qatar bank account? No, it's into Musk has it all. And then what Musk doesn't have, Larry Ellison has. So Larry Ellison's doing this one I've been reading about called Stargate, which I thought was to get to another dimension, but it's not at all. You know, remember that? It was a round thing and you could
yeah.
jump through it and you get to this other dimension. No, Stargate for Larry Ellison is to all of our biometric data and DNA data into one big thing. Now, the promise is that, like, we're never, no one's going to get cancer or die or anything because they have all our data.
I the cancer thing really bothers me because every time someone's like, oh, so you're anti-AI or something, which I'm not anti the concept of AI yeah. or machine learning or whatever. And they're like, well, what if it cures cancer? And I'm like, well, is that the application that we're discussing? No, we're discussing a completely different application where they're harvesting biometric data to do healthcare surveillance pricing. Like,
right
now, AI is being used to deny people healthcare. If AI was being used to grant people healthcare, I would support that application of it.
Right. And the interesting thing then, I mean, going back to the press, and it's because it is a kind of a tesseract or a fractal of influences, then is so the when you write about the manufactured outrage cycles in mainstream media, the manufactured outrage cycles perpetrated by the billionaires of mainstream media outlets, which mm-hmm. include Twitter and Paramount and CBS, then fuel the parental outrage and desire for the very child protections that are reifications of the surveillance apparatus.
Yes. It just all feeds in. Like, this moral panic is so convenient. It's so convenient for big tech. Like, the focus is 100% on the users and regulating speech, which allows them to harvest more and more data. None of it targets their actual, you know, business model. And you see that through Meta funding these front groups like the Digital Childhood Alliance, or like, you know, just these fake groups that like basically exist to push, again, legislation that doesn't really target the companies. But to target the companies, it's a more nuanced thing. And people, you know, a lot of these politicians can't even turn their computer on, and they don't, they're getting advice from Peter Thiel.
I have well-meaning friends, right? Well-meaning friends in the sort of nonprofit NGO sector that lose their jobs in corporate whatever or lost their job here. And then the opportunity is to start like a kind of, and I know three or four of them now, sort of grifty, child protecting NGO, you know, Save the Children. They'll find a couple of, you know, really smart young high school students to come out and do panels in DC at Brookings or somewhere, and basically peddle.
And they all profit.
They all profit.
It makes me so mad because the people fighting this are trans rights organizations with no money. Groups like Fight for the Future that got their funding dropped because they fought the Kids Online Safety Act. Again, something that Elon Musk continues to boost. Like, the people that fight, or sex workers, it's like, it's no one. They have no funding. They have no money. And then they're going up against, like you said, this nonprofit industrial complex that is, by the way, enacting like the Heritage Foundation's tech policy.
Like, I know. I know. There was like, it's like, I mean, I wake up to this every decade in a different way. Like, when I look at, like, as a college kid, I look at Bill Clinton and go, oh, wait a minute. This is very Reaganite. This isn't, you know, and it just keeps happening. But these folks, it is out of almost Project 2025 in terms of the way they understand tech. It's like, then the only one I could find who's speaking our language is like the Pope.
Yeah, I know, which is so hilarious. I know. That's such a funny, like, side arc that we have this, like, amazing, like, American Pope that, like, somehow has more clarity, like, moral clarity than, like, anyone in the U.S., like, media even. Like,
yeah,
it's hilarious, especially as an Irish Catholic. But, like, I don't know. It makes me depressed, and it makes me depressed to see like the media's complicity in it. As you mentioned, like these media companies are also owned by billionaire owners, and you can see the way that they have exerted influence over the coverage, like not just at the Washington Post, but a lot of these outlets. And I think that's incredibly disappointing because we're not getting this nuanced coverage of technology that we deserve. And I was thinking of this response that Elena Kagan, the justice, made after Gonzalez v. Google, which was this, you know, big challenge to Section 230 that the Supreme Court chose not to hear back in 2023. But she's like, she makes a joke. She's like, well, we're not exactly the 9 greatest experts about the internet, ha, ha, ha. And like everyone in the press galley is like laughing. And she's like, so maybe basically Congress can figure it out. And I'm like, okay, that's actually really disturbing because the internet is like the most disruptive, like, technology of our time. It's like greatly affecting our like political and economic ecosystem. And like the fact that you guys are the Supreme Court and you're like laughing, like, oh, we don't really know about all that stuff. Like you need to take it seriously. And like, they do, obviously they hear, you know, these big cases, but like, I think they fundamentally like kind of don't take it seriously in a way and like don't have an understanding of it.
No. And government and policymakers don't either. I mean, back when I was coming up, I had friends who went to work for Microsoft to write legislation for Congress. Well, you know, our friend, you know, Dana Boyd, brilliant person, right? She graduated Berkeley and started, got a job at Microsoft. I'm like, what are you doing for Microsoft? And she goes, well, I'm actually writing the internet kids legislation. Like, oh, and you mail it to them? And then they pretty much print it up right in the law. You know, and that's from industry to it's coming down that way. But even the regulation the other way, like I know you've been saying, and maybe I'll explain it in my way so you can explain why it's wrong. So Section 230, you mentioned that a couple of times. So Section 230, as I understood it, came up sort of back in the day when we had like email and Usenet groups and all this stuff. We were writing emails and posting things online, and the institutions that had the servers, and sometimes it was companies, but mostly institutions, colleges, whatever, who owned the servers on which that stuff was being posted didn't want to be responsible for what was there. You know, like, what if I, say, put up a recipe that's poison or someone gets killed or whatever? And so Section 230 was kind of originally about them not having responsibility for that. And then I thought social media companies took advantage of it.
Well, okay, let's be clear, because I think that's like what the reason that it was founded, right? The original case, I can't remember if it was the CompuServe one or the Prodigy one. It was CompuServe and Prodigy, right? The two biggest internet service providers. They both hosted these little like AOL style internet. I'm sure you were on this, like internet environments, right?
Yeah.
And so actually this whistleblower for the Wolf of Wall Street, the guy that Jordan Belfort, who ended up committing scams, right? There was a whistleblower that went on one of those forums and was like, hey, this guy is committing scams. Jordan Belfort, the worst of Wall Street, sued, right? And was like, no, you need to shut the down. Like, CompuServe is responsible for, you know, this content, basically, because you're publishing it. It's defamatory of me. This is a whistleblower, right?
Right.
And so basically the courts ruled like, no, because they weren't taking any moderation. CompuServe didn't know the content that was on there. They didn't moderate it in any way.
And they certainly aren't publishers in that case.
Exactly. And we don't want to treat them as a newspaper because then there would be no user-generated content. Prodigy did make an effort to moderate, and then that ruling determined that because they moderated at all, they would be responsible to everything. So obviously it created this perverse incentive where it's like, you either don't moderate at all or you moderate everything. So Section 230 comes along and says, look, if you are the speaker of the content, because the internet is not like the real world, like it's not like the physical world where there is this sort of like commons, the only sort of common spaces on the internet are corporate spaces, basically, primarily, or like spaces that like an entity has to set up, right? There's no physical world on the internet. It's only places that people have set up. And so in order to have any free speech online, you cannot treat those spaces as the speakers of the content, right?
Right.
You should be responsible for your own speech. Alex Jones, if he goes online, he should be responsible for his own speech. Now, I see how it got warped on social media. And I like I said, I have a lot of criticisms about the social media companies. But attacking Section 230, which is a foundational internet law and allows for us to like leave a negative review about a restaurant on Yelp, like is not something that we should mess with right now, especially under the Trump administration. Before we've done all the other things, like 90% of the negative effects of social media, of like these algorithms and the outreach, could be achieved through like data privacy and like all these other privacy regulations, right? And like, you know, regulating them in very different ways. And so I don't think we need to attack this like foundational law that protects, that it primarily exists to protect free speech online from users. And right now, sorry, last thing I say is like ever since FOSTA SESTA, let's not forget that the only reason FOSTA SESTA passed was because of Meta's, you know, aggressive support of it. These big social media platforms actually don't care if Section 230 is repealed because they have massive AI systems that can moderate content at scale. So now they're kind of like, oh, actually, Section 230, you can take that away because we can mass moderate.
But they already mass moderate at scale. I mean, that's what they've been doing the whole time.
But they're not pre-screening every single piece of content.
No, they're not screening at all. I mean, the reason why I don't think the 230 applies to them is once you're using an algorithm to choose what I get, you're a publisher and you should be responsible for what you've done.
There were always filtering mechanisms. This idea that algorithms are new or different or something, there have always been different editorial decisions even back in the CompuServe and Prodigy days, the featured post there were always mechanisms by which they were exerting like quote unquote editorial control. But the most important thing is like, again, I don't even want to hear about Section 230 until we regulate, do all the actual thoughtful regulation that could target, because what these people bring up when you say, why do you want to repeal Section 230? Joseph Gordon-Levitt on The Hill the other day, right? Like, he's talking about, like, online radicalization. And it's like, that's I have problems with those algorithms too. We should have transparency laws. We should have privacy laws. We should protect their ability to exploit us. That's the fundamental problem.
Right. If we had privacy, then the algorithms couldn't track us the same way.
They don't have data on us.
Right.
Yeah, and giving right. users more control over their online experience, allowing users to have things like, I mean, I've dealt with a lot of like online harassment or whatever, and it drives me crazy because it's like we all should have more power over our online experience. It took years for Twitter to even add the like limitations to who can reply to you, you know?
Right.
That's something these platforms should launch with, like the ability to block content, like all
right.
of this stuff.
Or that to tune your own algorithm, you know, to
yes.
tune whether how much violent, how much whatever, you know?
But if we remove Section 230, we remove all of those user controls as well. So we need to protect, like, at least, listen, even if I can't get people to protect Section 230, which I think they should do, at least ignore it for now until we get all this other stuff done. And then I promise you, if there's any problems, we'll address it. But like the other thing that bothers me is like, yes, are these tech giants bad and exploitative? Sure. But why is it only them that are, there is also a lot of, I report on a lot of extremely dangerous, you know, like incel forums, extremist communities. Why are those not being like, focusing on big tech just pushes people towards these more extreme, smaller places that I think if we had privacy, right, we had a lot of this law, these laws like would fix it at every scale. It's the same reason people are like protect the kids. It's like, well, why just protect the kids? These algorithms don't get benign when you turn 19. Like we should fix everyone's user experience.
Just want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Everyone's Earth, maker of these brand new puppies, Kobe Laundry Buds. These are in place of detergent or in place of those little plastic pods. These are healthy, good for the world. They're just like pills. You chuck it in the washer, throw in the laundry, turn it on and, you know, run a normal cycle with just this. No laundry detergent, no nothing else. No chemicals, no plastics, no bad. Just put this in and your clothes get clean. The world is saved. The babies can wear these clothes washed in this stuff and not get all irritated like they do from detergent. This stuff's great. And then when you're done with the bag, you just put it in the landfill. It's that good. All right. Kobe Laundry Buds. Go to KobeClean.com. Put in the discount code TEAMHUMAN just from now to like March 15th. Put TEAMHUMAN and you get 31% off. It's our big farewell to our loving sponsor of the year, Kobe Everything. What you're reminding me of is, for me, my most emotionally charged experience of your career was that the institutional newspapers you were writing for didn't have your back.
Oh, well, yeah.
In a profound way. Right. Now, for me, part of the reason I was happy you were at a big publication was it's safer for you. Like as a freelancer, like the one time I wrote sort of bad stuff about 4chan, it wasn't good for my whole life. I mean, everything happened and I had nobody. I'm just in my apartment. You know, in my apartment, I just got my little kid, you know, I'm just like, oh my God, you know, if you're like at the Times or at the Washington Post and you venture into speaking about Gamergate or what's going on, where were they? Do you know?
It's not even what's so frustrating to me. And it's not my editors. I have to tell you, my editor, Mark Seibel, Puy Wing, every single editor that I've ever had has been phenomenal. It's the bosses. It's the management people what was so frustrating to me is I don't even care if they issue a statement or whatever. Like, I don't care about that. What I care is that, like, I know how online attention works. And when somebody lies about you online especially when Fox News or like Tucker Carlson was doing his like nightly segment on me for a while, like you have to respond aggressively. If you don't let the person who's like, don't respond in any way or provide any counter narrative, you create a vacuum where they dominate.
Right.
And a lot of this stuff is exacerbated by people in the media. For instance, I don't know, media columnist at NPR who just personally hates me and is going to happily write up, you know, someone like Tucker Carlson would say, or like lies from some right winger, you know, and like launder that then through the mainstream media back. Like, it's all very toxic. But like, I think what was so frustrating to me is like, I couldn't correct all of this stuff in real time. So like something would come out, it would be like a gross misrepresentation of, you know, whatever the sort of like controversy of the time was. And I would be like, hey, I have the receipts to show like, this is not true. Like, can I respond? And the bosses would be like, no, no, just, and that's like, okay, so I'm taking the reputational hit. And right. By the way, the only reason they're attacking me is because I work at this place, but I have to take this reputational hit and I can't respond, you know, because you're saying so. And like, it just eventually, like, I mean, by the time my editor retired, like, and the Washington Post, like, it just became too much. I was just like, I want to be able to respond. I want to be able to, like, and when I had editors that were supportive, like, it was great. But the thing is, it's the boss. It's the management.
Right.
Because they believe, here's the thing, they agree with those people. Like,
that's
we have the New York
thing.
Times. Like,
in
that's
the end,
the
they
problem.
Do. Your editors don't because they're like us. But the bosses, or certainly the whoever, the shareholder board kind of people, you know, as soon as it wasn't in family control anymore and it wasn't about let's bring the news to people. Right. I mean, so basically we go all the way back to Gamergate and leading to the election of Donald Trump, which is that wait a minute, women are scary and mean and they're not letting boys be boys. They're coming into the last spaces that we have and trying to change our behavior and make us feel bad about ourselves. And anybody who writes sympathetically about those people must be eliminated.
It was crazy. There's also just so much misogyny. Like, if you look at who are the media reporters at these outlets, like Dylan Byers, like I'll say him by name, many, many others, it's all men. It's almost all exclusively men. And the way that they covered, specifically, like when I got my job, when I left the Times to become a columnist, like, you know, I started, like I said, as a blogger. I'm a millennial blogger. There's a lot of other male millennial bloggers, Ezra Klein, Matt Yglesias, all these people that are like even a couple years older than me, but like generally, relationally, like my peers. They are never called attention whores. They're never called, you know, the way that they would write about me is like relentless self-promote or whatever. I'm like, yeah, I'm on social media. I cover social media. I have a TikTok. Like, but why is that like gendered language never said towards men?
Right.
And it was always this sort of conflating me with like the stuff that I cover, which is like the influencer world. And
right.
Like,
but you got it from both sides though. You're on the one hand, you're the influencer trollop commercial, whatever. But
yeah.
On the other, you're the woke.
I know.
You know what I mean? So you got, so you get both. It's like the media version of Madonna whore. It's like, you're both woke and sold out. It's like, well,
it's
pick one.
It's crazy.
You know? Yeah.
I know. And also like, it's just been so interesting too, because like, as I've gone independent, like I don't even have any advertisers like at all, because I'm not like brand safe. Like I just do everything myself. I'm 100% supported by like people that subscribe to me, but like, I don't sell out to do anything. I don't have any speaking gigs. I don't do anything. Like I would honestly like to do more. I know I'm not brand
safe. You can have
speaking
gigs.
But I'm not like a corporate, I don't really, I talk a lot about like privacy and stuff that's not, I'm sure I could probably find some if I put my heart into it, but I'm just saying like, I'm not like doing the like sellout thing that I could be doing if I wanted to like go hard and just make a lot of money and just tell people what they wanted to hear about like child safety or the influencer world and talk about like, I'm a victim of online harassment and that's why we need, you know, COSA or something. Like,
yeah, it has come around though. I just got a speaking offer from Brazil to talk about
okay.
how can we make the internet more human again. And
I love,
you know,
that.
So I know Brazil, see, they're the future.
I think there's like a bunch of cool people. I love 404 Media, which some of my friends run at that. And like, there's just a lot of like cool independent media people that I have like a lot of solidarity with. And I think that hopefully like brands and companies will realize that there's value in engaging with people like us.
Right. I mean, and what I was hoping was, you know, things like, you know, like User are placeholders for future collectives, right? I mean, you don't plan to be the only writer for User Mag, do you?
I don't know. I mean, the newsletter is only like 10% of my time because making video content, and I make everything. I do
that.
Everything myself.
Right.
I do
there's
everything.
All this stuff. There's all these edits in there, which makes it. I just record a I just talk to camera. You like have actual stuff in there.
I edit it. Yeah. And then also put like thumbnails. I write the description. Like I just started a live streaming channel. So like I think video content as a whole is just more time consuming. And I freelance. I still do freelance sometimes for like traditional media. So it's a lot. But I would love to hire somebody to like, you know, like work on it with me or like be my editorial assistant. It's only been a year. I've only been independent for a year and 2 months. So
because I'm just wondering if as independents we're better like forming magazines of us, you know, of collectives of 5-10 writers who are all, if not agreeing on things, at least, you know, coming somehow related.
I like collaboration. Yeah. I think it's good to like band together and push this, also push people to like challenge where they get their news from and say like, look, there are these alternative like collectives and help like sort of cross-pollinate that way.
Right. Because I was thinking, like, I was looking at the tech billionaires want us dead meme, right? So it's one of your latest videos.
That was my clickbait title. I was like, should I do the clickbait title?
Of course. Of course. Especially for that. It's true. So there's that. And you did that. And then it was like a few months ago, there was, you know, Astra Taylor and Naomi Klein did that piece for The Times. And then before that, I did my, Survival of the Richest book. So there's
which was,
meme.
I cited it in my video.
I know you did. I saw with the cover and everything. Yeah, so we've been on this, and I've been on this one since I met those guys in 2018. You know, the idea that they're not just trying to escape from the causes of their own effects, but they really are ready to dispense with humanity. That, and they're saying it out loud, that this isn't conspiracy theory. This is what they're saying, that they are the transhuman ones who get the wings and get off the planet, and we're the ones who stay and at best squirm around in the mud, but probably just die in some Mad Max radioactive horror. But so you agree that these folks are, or many of them are actually pro-extinction.
Oh, I mean, yes, only because like I've also covered these people and I talk to people that believe in those things that are not billionaires, that follow these ideologies. And I mean, somebody like Emil Torres and Timnit and like others have like really covered it as well, like in detail. But I think fundamentally they don't have solidarity or see themselves as part of humanity, broader humanity. And I think even if maybe some of them don't like actively like want us dead in the sense that if you ask them, they won't say like, answer that terrible Peter Thiel answer with Ross Douthat where he's like, I don't know if the human race should continue. Like they still hold these eugenic beliefs or they still hold these like this idea that like they are separate and that they are a separate. And I do think that like you see this kind of thinking in Silicon Valley, but also in Washington, D.C. Like when I worked as a political reporter for 2 years, like there's this idea that like they're all in this bubble and like they are all going to be sort of separated from the like worst effects of their policies and like what they're enacting on the rest of the country or the world. And I think that that's really dangerous thinking. We want people that are in power and legislating that have solidarity with broader humanity and that like understand, like view themselves as like, you know, true members of the public.
Yeah. I mean, which is why you could even look at, you know, you can look at footage of the January 6th thing. And it's like, yeah, they had to get to safety, but the way that the senators or whatever, it's like, oh, we're going down into our underground bunker and through our special passages. Like, we're ready for that. We're ready for that. You know, and there's copters waiting, you know, once we get out, we'll get taken to, you know, the Air Force base. You know, this, I mean, which is the fantasy of, you know, 20 different shows on streaming media now. It's the you know, not just the bunker fantasy, but like a secret civilization underground or on a different planet or in a...
Well, they think they can buy their way out of like whatever bad stuff is going to happen to everyone, including climate change and all this other stuff. And in some ways they can buy themselves, you know, sort of insulate themselves from a lot of the horrible things that they're doing to the world. But it's bad. Like that's bad. And also like, we don't want that system.
Right. I mean, but it's been the model they've had all along. It's like, you know, talk about Brazil. You go to a city like São Paulo and there's this like super wealthy little enclave in the middle of a very poor city where, you know, 30% of people are hungry. And it's like, and I guess they look at the world as if there's just not enough resources for everybody. So this is the way we already live. And it's going to get exacerbated when the shit hits a fan.
Yeah, but that's depressing. I don't want to live in that world.
It's depressing and it's wrong, I think. And I guess it was interesting because when I watched your last video, which people should look at, and I think it was called Tech Billionaires Want Us Dead.
Yeah.
And it started out with the original tech internet culture that I was a part of in the, you know, late 80s and early 90s. We had such positive hippie dreams of it. And then I'm wondering if some of those dreams were so psychedelic and utopian and abstracted that we took our eyes off the ball of the social reality that was going on. It's like in the I wrote this novel Ecstasy Club about ravers, and there was a Grateful Dead girl who was among them, who was a social justice warrior, you know, but because the dead was still around at the beginning of the net, and she was one of them, and she just like a third of the way into the book, she disappears. They don't know where she is, and she's just gone. And then they don't even make much of it. And my point was that the sort of we forgot the 19. It's like we left the 1960s values in the car at the mall. You know, it's like and just went and got higher and into 120 beats per minute ecstasy. And maybe do you think that's part of the problem that we've gotten ourselves into this mess?
I think it's also just like capitalism and money like came in. I'm so sad that I wasn't like, I wish I was just like 10 years older and could have like experienced that internet before. Like, I mean, I had like, I'm a millennial and we had like Facebook, so it wasn't the social media world that kids are growing up with now. But like,
yeah,
it would have been so cool to like really, I mean, I had AIM, I guess, in like 1999. But like, I think that it's so interesting for me to like go back and read about that time because I'm like, was it always there? I think that it before the profit stuff came in,
right?
It wasn't as warped. And I do think the money, just like if you look at the timeline, like changed so much of that.
Yeah, it was like Dungeons and Dragons or something. You know, it was like too small a thing for them to care about.
Yeah, which you sort of saw that happen with the influencer industry, too, and like content creation, where like now it's so dystopian and they're just trying to get, I mean, it's like commoditize every single aspect of yourself and put it online and you just need to upload more TikToks and maybe that'll get you out of poverty. And like there was this great piece by Max Reed, who's one of my favorite writers, about like basically how like the American dream was sort of like dying by the 90s and like the internet and the influencer world sort of like reinvigorated this idea of the American dream and like anybody can make it. And like, it's all about how hard you work online and posting through it and stuff. And I think about that a lot when I see this stuff, and it's all in service of the tech companies making millions of dollars. I think just the media, like anytime people are like, oh, is the influencer industry over? Like every 3 years, somebody writes that piece. And
right.
I just think like over the past 20 years, like, or 25, probably longer, like the media is only getting more digital and more distributed. And like, there's more niches and there's more like, and also people are getting more and more online. So like the audiences for some niche, right? Like they may, like it's just bigger and bigger because more people are online. So the audience, like the sort of the baseline audiences for a lot of things just grow.
Right. And maybe it wouldn't be enough people to have supported one of the three network sitcoms. And, you know, it might not have been must-see Thursday night TV, but
yeah,
if you've got 1 million or 2 million diehard followers, you know, and they don't have to follow just you either. Most of those people probably follow 20, 30, 40 people that
yeah.
intensely.
Which it is the, like, idea of, like, what is that famous blog post, which I think is Andreessen Horowitz blog post. I hate to cite it, but it's, like, the 1,000 true fans idea
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah, which seems, I mean, sometimes they're going to be right, you know, Andreessen yeah. Horowitz. Sometimes they have to be, even if they're wrong about their you know, optimistic vision of the future of the crypto. I mean, they're still talking about the metaverse, aren't they?
I hate that they call themselves tech optimists, because it's like actually a very dystopian, miserable version of the future that they're promoting.
Right. Right. It's super dark, but it's optimistic if like you aspire to Qatar as your worldview, you know, with all of it's a resource curse place where data becomes the new resource in what amounts to a kind of a Middle East oil company or oil country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oy. So, but you do, and in end of most of your pieces, you get to what can we actually do about all this? I mean, or at least the start you know, the start of it, which is the important thing. You know, if they want to kill off humanity, what do we do? Do we seize their assets? You mentioned in one of yours, that's them's fighting words.
I would love to do that.
Yeah, you don't want ChatGPT to see you saying that.
I know. I think that tech regulation is like fundamentally broken. And like, I try to talk about this stuff so that more people on the left like care about tech policy. I think like having reported on this stuff for a while, like the far right has cared so much about tech policy and so much like they have such an aggressive, like tech policy is so core to their type of authoritarianism that they're like pushing, which is like tech authoritarianism. And I think people on the left like don't really have a response to that. And often they buy into these moral panics and they don't talk about it, or they don't even really understand how to like, I mean, the antitrust stuff is a good example where like nobody even covered that last year aside from like these tech business
Corey.
Type
yeah.
place. Corey's yeah. amazing. Corey, I would die for, I love Corey. I know. But Corey's one man. And like, I think we need a lot more Corey's. We need like hundreds of Corey's, thousands, as many as we can make. But there's just not that many. Same with you. Like there are some people and they're amazing. But when you look at that compared to like the right or like these massive messaging machines that these like fake stupid interest groups have or whatever, like it's nothing.
Right. And then the worst of the worst is at least we weren't going to make money. We weren't going to get super popular, but at least our perspective was considered cool. It's like,
yeah,
walk around the East Village or Dime Square or something, it's like you're a friggin' lefty socialist hippie. It's like that's the uncool way to be. And it's like, no, that's at least we get that. If we don't get the money, we should at least get to be cool.
I think that's gonna come back.
I think so too.
They're being so lame now that it's like maxing out. I hope.
You know, the part that I liked the best, and it was almost throwaway in the last video, and then you mentioned, you used the word before, was when you said the style of maximalism. And I stopped on that. So you were talking kind of about cultural movements, that we need cultural movements that recenter humans. And I'm like, well, good. I'm doing that one. Yeah. I can go to sleep now. I'm doing the thing. That was all good. I'm like, all right, I'm on, you know, the Taylor train. It's all good. But then when you were talking about that, you said, you know, there's been a resurgence of kind of maximalist style. And then it really, I started thinking, I mean, I became like almost like a New Models podcast person for a minute, like thinking about cultural movements and art and all. And I got it, that what you're suggesting is that the kind of Spartan pottery barn, you know, minimalism of that we've been living in, this kind of stark Spartan reality, is sort of anti-human. I see them. I was just in someone's loft space the other day. It's like maximalist. There's just all this stuff, all these collections, all these things from history. It's thick. And it was like, oh, that's kind of what you mean, that there's this texture, this human thing in there.
Yeah, it's like a human element, and it has like humanity and personality and like just a sense of like a human sensibility to it. Not everything is like optimized or designed, to like disappear and be easy or whatever. It's like, I don't know. I love people that have like those types of spaces wherever they are. But like you go to somebody's old home, right? And they have like all this stuff. Like, I don't know. I was even watching like Arrested Development season one, which is like from so long ago. But it's so interesting to see the changes in interior design, and like, it just, technology has become like everything looking like an Apple store. And
this Bauhaus super simplicity. And yeah, I know it. Exactly.
And they're pushing that on everyone.
And, right. Where when you said that, even though it was like half a sentence, I started to think of like Gertrude Stein living in the Algonquin. Yeah. Could you imagine piles of books and cigarettes and bottles and perfumes? God knows what she had.
I love that, though. Like, that is such a human, like a human is living in that space, you know, and like that stuff is like related to her life or her interests or whatever.
Right. As opposed to now, we hide everything's got to be in a little Marie Kondo little drawer, you know, disappeared from view.
Maybe I'm a slob and I'm coping here, but I
no,
like...
No, you look very neat. Like... your media representation is not maximalist.
But I like having things that like mean something and also that are made by humans, like that are like my Colorado pillow that's needle pointed are like things that somebody made. And I think that's hard to find. It's like supporting. I want people to support other human beings also.
Yeah. And it can sound consumerist and you even mention it. And it's not that, oh, buy stuff that's made by people.
No.
It's live in the world of we live in a world of things, of stuff, of artifacts.
It's all just disposable, too. Like, my dad's, my family's works in construction, and, like, so much of, like, even building practices have changed where it's all, like, optimized and it's all, like, houses are not built to last more than 30 years and stuff. And I just think, like, there's a, I don't know, like, there's something to, like, buying something and, like, having it stay with you or, like, doing something to your house that, like, makes it more you, that's not just, like, cookie cutter and... I don't know. You know who's really good on this is Brian Merchant. I don't know if you ever read his stuff.
He
wrote this book about the Luddites, which is so good.
He was on a couple months ago. Yeah. It's wonderful.
Oh, he's a great person. But like he's changed my view on a lot of stuff, too, where I used to be like, oh, why do I need an analog whatever? And I'm like, wait, I kind of like that.
Yeah. And it's not, I mean, it's weird. It's not just style. It's also, I mean, real materialism is not a bad thing. My dad gave me his transistor radio, and I still have it, that he bought in the 40s or the 50s, and it works, and it's precious. But to take care of your things, like an artist taking care of their tools, to respect the value of it rather than everything being, you know, Target and I'm going to, or H&M, I'm going to throw it out. You know, there's no vintage clothes that are going to, from our era, that will last.
No. Well, they'll last in landfills like forever, but they're not made to even like survive like, like four wears after being washed. So like, I just think like finding unique things too that like you actually care about that you want. And it's not just buying into this like not fast fashion only, but just like fast light, like the Temu lifestyle kind of.
Right. Right. Which even the kids are getting out of. Although I think there is this drive, this to reconnect to ground, to stuff, to the object world.
Yeah. It's like an exhaustion and it's a lot and we're constantly just sold crap. And like, especially when it comes to technology, like consumer tech, like everybody wants to sell you some new gadget to optimize this and this. And like, I think just trying to get off that a little bit is good.
Yeah. I mean, people forget, you know, I'm just starting a monologue on this. The real world is still bigger than the digital world. It's still, even with AI, the real world is bigger than all the servers and all the likes and all the influencers combined. And I think people are, and that's nothing against the net, because I'll still love the net and all the things it does and all that. But I feel like our power to influence that virtual world is back here in real world.
I also really like human digital spaces too, that are like cool places online that somebody made that feel unique and special and fun and like handcrafted, kind of like, I don't know, there's this movement called like digital homesteading of like people making their own websites and communities again. And I really like that too.
Yeah, there's like a NeoCities. I don't know if you know that one.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really simple HTML built. It's like, I used to have a website and it was funky and different, but everybody's website was different. That's why you had your own homepage. It's like, how are you going to organize it until we got all, you know, suburban cookie cutter on Facebook, which was easier. It gave more access. My parents could have their own pages at that point, but you lose, you know, and I guess
you lose like the human.
You want room for both, I suppose, you know, and Facebook's not going to just say, oh, you can put your own crazy page here. It was like a zoned, very strict zoning laws in what your house looks like in that world.
That's why I liked Tumblr, because Tumblr, you could edit the feed always looked consistent, but you could edit your own themes on your own page.
Maybe this is a good thing to close on. But as someone who was there and who watches the media, we're the closest thing to media writers these days, I think. It seems to me that the demise of the Post is an intentional thing, that it's not some business decision, that it's basically all of the big tech billionaire, trillionaire people are just making offerings to the current administration. And this was, no, don't worry, I'm not going to sell the Washington Post to some lefty, you know, I'm not going to sell it to a Mediar or someone. I'm going to just end it as the force it was.
Yeah, 100%, like 100%. And I don't think you install someone like Will Lewis if you don't want that destruction to happen, because it was so intentional what they did. And it's sad. I don't know. It's just sad because there are so many talented people there. But I'm not like, I don't know. It's the problems are so much bigger than just the Post. I think all of media has been gutted, obviously. So it's sort of,
I mean, maybe it'll be cool. You know, if we can encourage people to fund independent media, people who are really working like you, you know, who are actually reporting. And, you know, I was looking, you know, Judd Legum is doing some interesting stuff. My friend Jonathan Larson does the fucking news. They're people reporting, you know, and making even MS Now, I guess they're independent now. They're no longer.
Yeah.
NBC.
Yeah, they spun out. Yeah. I'm a believer in independent media. That's like kind of, obviously, I started that way. And like, that was always the promise of blogging, which I was always very like, that's what I loved about being a blogger and why I got into media to begin with. So I hope it shakes out that way. I think the only way it could not go that way is if all of these bad tech laws pass and we can't have independent media anymore because the liability, because suddenly, you know, you have massive liability to publish independently online, and because the platform, you know, because that liability transfers, and now you're, you know, now we have a internet that is similar to the internet in a lot more authoritarian countries where the media landscape is not great.
Right. And it's really hard to get mainstream media monopolies that have already surrendered their agency to an essentially authoritarian regime to write stories educating people on the importance of maintaining internet law that supports independent media.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's not going to happen. But yes.
So it's up to us. It's up to us, right?
Yes. Well, you're doing the Lord's work, so
I'm doing the Lord's work. You're doing.
There's
you're
dozens
doing
of us.
Even more. Yeah. Yeah. But thank you. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for keeping this torch alive. And especially, it is, you know, culture used to be, it's kind of entertainment. It used to be close to the entertainment section. Now culture is the human survival section.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's where we're going to, it's where we can foster and replicate the sensibilities, I think, that are going to keep this project going.
Yeah, 100%.
Well, thank you. Everybody go to usermag.co to find, or just type Taylor Lorenzo, just click on whatever in the show notes. You know, I mean, it's easy. Get a screen capture and put it in Google image search, and it'll probably find her YouTube.
You'll find some deranged Fox News articles about me, I think, that way.
Excellent. Everyone deserves anyone who hasn't gotten one good episode with Fox hasn't lived. Thank you for being on Team Human, and thank you all for being on Team Human. You can support independent media. That's what this counts as, by going to teamhuman.fm and clicking on support. Join us on Patreon. We're starting new things for people, right? Because we want people to join and not see the ads, but more important, to join. We love you. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. And I'm Douglas Rushkoff. You've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps. In case you missed it, we are sponsored by Everyone's Earth, maker of these Kobe Laundry Buds. It's a brand new product. These are good for the world laundry buds. No plastic, no polyvinyl, no horrible stuff. You put it in the washer instead of anything else. Just put this in and your laundry and wash them. this will totally dissolve and then go out into the Hudson or wherever your laundry water goes, and it won't kill the fish and do all that bad stuff. It's all good. All right, so get this, Kobe Laundry Buds. Go to KobeClean.com, put the code TEAMHUMAN in there, and you get 31% off your purchase. All right, so check it out, Kobe Laundry Buds. I actually use these. All right, be good.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, this is Zibby Owens, host of Totally Booked with Zibby, formerly Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. In my daily show, I interview today's latest, best-selling, buzziest, or underrated authors and story creators whose work I think is worth your time. As a bookstore owner, publisher, author, and obviously podcaster, I get a comprehensive look at everything that's coming out and spend my time curating the best books so you don't have to. Stay in the know, get insider insights, and connect with guests like Grammy Award-winning singer Alicia Keys, critically acclaimed author Judy Blume, and Academy Award-winning screenwriter John Irving, every single day. With Totally Booked, you aren't just listening, you're part of the story. So don't miss out. Follow Totally Booked with Zibby on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.